Today is Tuesday, November the 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up, U.S. House of Representatives committee is conducting an impeachment probe of President Donald Trump, released the first transcripts of one of their closed-door witness interviews on Monday.
I really don't know her, but if you look at the transcripts, the president of Ukraine was not a fan of hers either. I mean, he did not exactly say glowing things. I'm sure she's a very fine woman. I just don't know much about her.
Also ahead, police in Uganda's capital Kampala fired tear gas at a group of journalists as the reporters protested police brutality. Those stories and more coming up on International Edition. U.S. House of Representatives committee is conducting an impeachment probe of President Donald Trump, released the first transcripts of their closed-door witness interviews on Monday. The transcripts were of interviews of former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and Michael McKinley, a former senior advisor to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. For insight on some of the revelations contained in the transcripts, I'm joined by VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, tell us, what did we learn from the key witness transcripts that were released today from the House?
So we really just got started with what's going to be a flood of transcripts from the House Intelligence Committee that'll be coming out throughout this week. Mm-hmm. The first two transcripts that we got today talked with a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and other officials who started to really fill in the details of this picture. They certainly are not the House Intelligence Committee's star witnesses, but they're starting to fill in that picture about the role Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, played in U.S.-Ukraine policy, as well as some of the concerns that these U.S. officials raised about the way the president was conducting foreign policy.
So it paints a picture that Giuliani, in a way, was kind of at the epicenter of this whole alternate or shadow diplomacy. From the legal standpoint, does it say that Giuliani did anything illegal?
Well, these officials are just talking about what was going on, and they raised concerns that they said allegedly was illegal, namely that the U.S. State Department was being asked to involve itself in the president's domestic political considerations and obtaining visas for people that should not have obtained visas to the United States.
So the extent so far is obtaining visas, basically helping them get visas for
right, as well as some of the larger concerns about what Rudy Giuliani was trying to do in terms of U.S. foreign policy with Ukraine.
So public hearings are going to be starting very soon, I'm assuming this week or next week at some point. Are they going to bring back these officials who testified behind closed doors, and what's the value for that?
You can bet that they want to get these officials back in public testifying when the U.S. House of Representatives comes back into session next week after the Veterans Day holiday. The benefit of that is that it will address some of the Republican criticism of the impeachment inquiry, and that's namely that up until now it's been conducted behind closed doors. Now, House Democrats argue that that needs to be so that they can build their investigation and keep the witnesses from cooperating or alternating their stories after hearing from each other. Now that House Democrats have built their case, built the investigation, they can take it out into public and use those hearings to really make a case to the American people about articles of impeachment.
So yesterday, the president and many members of Congress who are part of the GOP, they're calling for the unmasking of the whistleblower. Mm-hmm. His lawyer says he's willing to talk to GOP members who are on the who are leading the investigation. Have they taken him up on that offer yet?
Right. So we're in a little bit of a back and forth right now between the whistleblower's attorney and the Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee. The whistleblower's attorney has offered to answer questions submitted in writing in response in writing. Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee are saying this is absolutely not enough. They are calling for a hearing and what would most likely be a public hearing where we would see the whistleblower testifying. I don't see that happening because of the privacy concerns, because of these concerns about the threats that this whistleblower has received. That would be a blockbuster hearing to have that person come out into public and testify.
And the protections, too. He's protected under the law.
He absolutely is. So that would be a big concern.
But what is the angle here? What is the strategy that to put him in public or unmask him somehow makes their case or helps the case?
Well, what the House Republicans are, their case namely rests on attacking the whistleblower's motives in coming out and filing this complaint. They said that this person has underlying political motives, that they voted Democrat, that they don't like President Trump, that they're just trying to get back at him through this complaint. Whereas House Democrats are saying, we've gone far beyond the whistleblower complaint at this point.
Right.
We're at the point where there's a whole pattern that has been laid out because of these officials testifying in those closed-door depositions. They want to say, this is going beyond that whistleblower. We're far past that
point. And the transcript that kind of backs up some of the things that he said.
Absolutely. You know, there's the phone call transcript is actually a summary. So the White House likes to call it a transcript, but it's not actually a transcript.
It's
more
verbatim.
Of a summarization of what happened on that phone call. House Democrats also want to remind the American people that there are witnesses who have seen a pattern, not just on that phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president, but a pattern of behavior, and mostly involving Rudy Giuliani, who I would bet is going to be subpoenaed to show up for the House Intelligence Committee
and we'll wait,
sooner,
we'll
if
wait
not later.
We'll wait to see if he actually does make an appearance. Catherine Gibson, thank you very much for talking to us.
You're so welcome.
That was VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Yesterday's transcripts were the first released from the closed-door inquiry by the House of Foreign Affairs, Intelligence and Oversight panels. They paint a detailed picture of some of the concerns expressed by top U.S. diplomats as Trump allies tried to pressure Ukraine to investigate domestic political rivals. As the hearings enter a new phase and the House prepares for public hearings that could start this month, Reuters reports that Lev Parnas, an indicted Ukrainian-American businessman who has ties to President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is now prepared to comply with congressional impeachment investigators. So, as Congress prepares for public hearings, what should we expect and what does this new development mean to the inquiry? And for that, I reached Professor Craig Albert, an associate professor of political science at Augusta University. Professor Albert, as the public hearings are set to start, I believe, sometime next week, what should we expect in terms of the optics? I'm asking this remembering some of the drama that played out during the closed hearings.
I think you can look for something quite similar to what we've seen so far, and you'll look for each side, the Democrats and the Republicans, trying to play to their bases and trying to get points for the election. I think right now, more than anything, the impeachment inquiry is trying to nudge people to vote one way or another for the upcoming election, to gain publicity, and to position each of the parties in a particular narrative. So you can probably see some Republican grandstanding, as well as some serious allegations by the Democrats and really trying to hone in on high crimes and misdemeanors by President Trump.
U.S. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said today that he expected the four White House officials that were scheduled for depositions for them not to come. Does this add to an obstruction charge eventually?
It definitely depends on how you view or contextualize obstruction of justice. So according to the Democrats, this is ample evidence pointing towards another example of obstruction of justice. For Republicans, they're just saying the president has the right to ask these individuals not to go to these meetings, not to go to the inquiry, because the inquiry is illegal and unconstitutional, even though they had the vote on the inquiry last week in the House. So it depends on how one describes or contextualizes obstruction of justice. But this is definitely how the Democrats will push this, is that those four individuals not showing up today is obstruction of justice.
If in the end of this process, Congress doesn't vote to impeach the president, what are some of the long-term consequences for either parties?
Well, I think either way, there's going to be long-term consequences, not just for the parties, but the party system in the United States and our government and politics overall. I think that we will see some type of vote coming out of the Judiciary Committee, however. So how this is going to play out is that the House Intelligence Committee, which is pretty much the lead committee on this, will hand over the inquiry reports to the House Judiciary Committee, and then the Judiciary Committee will decide to take a vote or not on articles of impeachment. So some type of vote probably will take place in the House Judiciary Committee, and there will be a lot of evidence and open reports and investigations that the American people can read for themselves on this issue. I think the most important thing to remember about this is that an impeachment inquiry shows that there is something that appeared to be scandalous or something approaching some types of crimes, and that is alarming for the American public that maybe some type of corruption could be entering the United States political spectrum at the highest levels of office. And so how the political parties play out this narrative will have a significant impact on the future of American politics.
Now, indicted Rudy Giuliani associate, Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, that his associate, Lev Parnas, is actually willing to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry. How important is this development as the investigations enter this next phase?
I think the more high-level delegates, the more high-level individuals associated to President Trump that the inquiry can get to testify, the more likely it is that you'll see a vote happen in one of these committees. The more evidence that they're going to have, the more examples of something that can be charged with something resembling high crimes and misdemeanors or obstruction of justice. And that's what the Democrats are really trying to do, is to get enough people to testify so that they can show the intent by the president to either obstruct justice or, worse, to interfere with the United States elections, which would be a high crime and misdemeanor.
Now, one of those high-level individuals is former security advisor Bolton. He has been subpoenaed to testify along with cabinet secretaries, other agency heads, and other top officials. Do you expect Ambassador Bolton to testify?
I do not see him testifying. He remains a very loyal Trump ally, even though there were differences that resulted in Bolton leaving the office. But I don't think he'll testify. I don't think he is for the impeachment inquiry whatsoever, so I wouldn't expect him to show up for that testimony. However, that again gives more evidence to the Democrats that President Trump is asking his former officials or current officials not to show up, which could be obstruction of justice.
That's Professor Craig Albert, an associate professor of political science at Augusta University. A new report finds that sanctions imposed on North Korea are failing to advance denuclearization prospects on the Korean Peninsula while causing immense suffering to the civilian population. An international multidisciplinary panel of independent experts compiled a report. The report is the first comprehensive assessment of the human impact of sanctions against North Korea. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations strengthened economic sanctions against North Korea in 2016 with the aim of bringing Pyongyang to the nuclear negotiating table with Washington. This tactic, however, has not worked. The talks remain deadlocked. While targeted sanctions against North Korea's elite are ineffective, authors of the report say evidence shows they are having a devastating impact on the general population, especially women and children. They say sanctions are adversely affecting humanitarian aid and economic development in the country. They cite UN agencies that report 40% of North Korea's population is going hungry and in desperate need of assistance. 6 out of 10 people do not have access to safe drinking water, and malnutrition among children is increasing. Christine Ahn is founder of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women to end the Korean War. She says the sanctions are barring the import of essential items, including medical equipment, agricultural material essential for food production, and components for water and sanitation programs. She says authors of the report warn the lack of these goods threaten the lives of the most vulnerable people in North Korea.
They assess that nearly 4,000 people died in 2018 as a result of the delays caused by the sanctions of materials and aid coming into North Korea, as well as the funding shortfalls.
Last year, UN agencies were able to raise only 21% of the $111 million they needed for urgent humanitarian programs, leaving a funding gap of $87 million. No progress has been made in nuclear negotiations since U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held a historic first face-to-face meeting in Singapore last year and signed a declaration promising to transform their relations. On tells VOA, the U.S. could advance this goal by partially lifting the sanctions that are hurting the civilian population.
This is something that the United States can do. It wouldn't do anything to cost anything to U.S. taxpayers, and I think it would go a long way to improving the basic security of North Korean people, and it could be a very concrete step towards advancing the step-by-step approach that ultimately will lead to denuclearization and a peace agreement.
Trump and Kim met a second time earlier this year in Hanoi, Vietnam. Those talks, however, ended with no agreement. An says it would be wise to involve women in the U.S.-North Korea nuclear talks. She says research shows when women are engaged in a peace process, their participation actually leads to a peace agreement, and one that is more likely to be durable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
These are some of the top stories in the world. Iraqi security forces killed at least five people when they opened fire on protesters in Baghdad on Monday as thousands took part in the largest wave of anti-government protests for decades. And the White House says that the U.S. President Donald Trump spoke with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi on Monday and voiced support for negotiations between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan over a giant hydroelectric dam on Ethiopia's Blue Nile. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com and at VOA Web Map. This is International Edition. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on all leaders in the world to show respect for the freedom of the press. But while a new wave of popular uprisings is emerging in the Arab world, 10 Arab countries are at the bottom of the World's Freedom Index for 2019, and there is a rise of counter-revolutionary efforts and authoritarian rule in the region. Sahar Khamis is Associate Professor for Media at the University of Maryland. He spoke to VOA reporter Mohamed El-Shenawi about the cyber war to silence the opposition in the Arab world.
The regimes have been looking, listening, watching, and learning, and really improving their own learning curves. So, for example, you have Syria, the Syrian Electronic Army, an army of hackers that really worked for the regime in order to go after the activists and the protesters, to hack, to sabotage, to block the websites, and even to go after the protesters in the real world. And so what we have been seeing is building this type of learning curve on the part of autocratic repressive regimes. We have seen cyber wars between activists on one side and regimes on the other side really escalating. We have seen, for example, the cyber armies and cyber troops, you know, being used by governments like Saudi Arabia to go after protesters and to go after activists, for example, and to try to really kind of halt their activism or halt their oppositional movements. And we are seeing similar trends in other repressive regimes in the region as well.
According to Reporters Without Borders World Freedom Index of 2019, 10 Arab countries are at the bottom among 180 countries. How do you explain that?
We can never divorce or separate the freedom of the press or freedom of expression from the overall social, economic, and political context in any country. Unfortunately, the Arab world is a region that suffers from multiple challenges, many complex set of issues and problems, including having very high illiteracy rates, socioeconomic challenges, high unemployment, and of course, the lack of freedom of expression and democracy at large. All of these factors combined create this kind of very low position in terms of freedom of the press and freedom of expression in many parts of the Arab world, because the media or the press, after all, is, in my opinion, both a cause and effect, a mirror and a molder. It does reflect the reality, and it also helps to shape it at the same time simultaneously. So all of these challenges combined create this really low position in terms of freedom of expression in the Arab world. And we have seen that the only country that really kind of emerged out of the Arab Spring uprising with some degree of success was Tunisia. The rest of the Arab countries had a lot of setbacks and detours in terms of the journey towards democratization and transformation and reform, and the media is both a cause and an effect of this process.
Why was Tunisia an exception among the Arab Spring countries in terms of press of freedom?
For a number of very important reasons, I think Tunisia was the only country that somehow really set a good example and a good model of a transition towards more smooth and peaceful path towards democratization and reform. It's a small country. It has a high literacy rate, over 90% literacy rate, unlike the rest of the Arab region that has very high illiteracy rates. Education is important in Tunisia. Women have been playing a very important role. Many of them are highly educated, highly empowered, even acting as judges and being at the table. I always say when women are at the table, they will not be on the menu. And this is very, very clear in the case of Tunisia. The ability to build successful coalitions and alliances across the board to bridge the differences between different groups that have different ideological and political positions has been very clear as well in the case of Tunisia, leading to a peaceful rotation of power. Unfortunately, this is not what we have been witnessing in the other so-called, quote-unquote, Arab Spring countries, where we have seen the setbacks in democracy and setbacks in the transformation towards socio-political transition, leading even in many cases to a worsening situation in terms of the overall political and social and economic situation compared to before the Arab Spring uprisings of 2011. I sincerely hope that the Tunisian example, what is sometimes referred to as the Tunisian exceptionalism, would be a model that the other Arab Spring countries and the other, you know, Arab countries in general, the whole region, would look up to and try to learn from.
That was Sahar Khamis. She's the Associate Professor of Media at the University of Maryland. She was speaking to VOA's reporter Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Police in Uganda's capital fired tear gas at a group of journalists on Monday, ironically, as the reporters protested alleged police brutality. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
A group of about 50 journalists had gathered at Kampala City Center to march to police headquarters and deliver a petition to the chief of police. The petition asks authorities to investigate and reprimand officers who were found guilty of assaulting journalists and to stop police brutality in the field. Last week, police allegedly assaulted four journalists who went to cover a strike at Makerere University over a 15% tuition increase. On Monday, police quickly dispersed the journalists' protest and briefly detained some of them. Alex Esagala, a photojournalist with the Daily Monitor newspaper, describes the scene.
As we were covering that protest, one of the commanders came and told me that today it is between life and death. And therefore, they started tear gassing us. The good thing, I was putting on a bulletproof, so it fell down. Then it exploded under my legs. I got severe injuries.
A few journalists were eventually allowed into the police headquarters to deliver the petition. Isaac Semakade is a lawyer who was among those tear gassed and bundled into a police pickup truck. Semakade, who represents many journalists in court, says his non-profit legal aid services is struggling to keep up with police and government actions against the media.
We are overwhelmed with the requests for rapid response, requests to unseal closed media houses. We are overwhelmed with requests to recover stolen and broken cameras and other media equipment. Something has to be done as we enter the general election cycle. Journalists all over Uganda are under threat. Let this threat not be minimized or normalized.
Onyango Patrick, a Kampala Metropolitan Police spokesperson, told VOA that the petition was received and would be delivered to the chief. Patrick says police and journalists need to respect each other.
We both need to understand each other's role. As a journalist, what am I supposed to do? As a police officer, what am I supposed to do in times of riots? So we both need each other, and we are both not wrong, and we are both not correct.
The Uganda Journalists Association leadership says reporters will not cover police functions until they hear from the police inspector general. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The Trump administration has notified the United Nations that it is formally setting in motion the process to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord by November 4th of 2020. AP's Thomas reports.
I followed through on my promise to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
That was President Trump, June 8th, 2017. But technically, the U.S. is still in. The terms of the Paris Agreement say no country can withdraw in the first 3 years. It took effect November 4th, 2016, so that means today is the first day the U.S. can start the withdrawal process. A letter to the U.N. will trigger it, and it will take a year to complete. That'll be the day after the 2020 presidential election. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron and Chinese President Xi Jinping will sign an agreement that includes the wording on irreversibility of the Paris Climate Agreement, an official from the French presidential office said on Tuesday. Protests in Lebanon continue even after Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned last week amid massive rallies that had paralyzed the nation's capital and spread around the small Mediterranean nation. Citizens mistrustful of the government came out again on Sunday to demand a whole new leadership. But supporters of the president, Michel Aoun, also showed up in large numbers to rally for the embattled leader. VOA's Zlatka Hoke has more.
President Aoun's supporters gathered in central Beirut, waving Lebanese flags and banners with his image. Sunday's pro-government rally was the largest demonstration against massive anti-government protests that began in mid-October and led to the resignation of Prime Minister Hariri last week.
Anti-government protesters think if the president leaves power, the problems would be solved. On the contrary, if that happens, the crisis will worsen.
Lebanon has accumulated huge debt after 8 years of civil war, which destroyed much of its infrastructure. Interest payments consume almost half of the government revenues, leaving many public sectors underfunded. Electricity supply is rationed, and many people have to rely on backup power generators. Transport, medical care, and other public services also are in desperate need of rehauling. The government has promised economic reforms to ease dependency on oil and gas revenues. Attempts to reduce the deficit by measures such as slashing the level of borrowing, hiking taxes, and cutting pensions over the past year have not helped.
We don't have jobs or income. Down with all of them. President Michel Aoun, Speaker Nabi Berri, and Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri. All means all.
In 2016, Saad Hariri, a Saudi-backed Sunni Muslim, formed a unity government with Iran-backed Shia group Hezbollah, ensuring some political stability. President Aoun is a Maronite Christian. But some protesters say a government based on sectarian lines is bringing the country down.
We achieved part of our demands, which is the ousting of the government. And now we demand a neutral technocrat government and not a political one.
Joining protesters who demand economic and political reforms on Sunday was a large gathering of women calling for social changes.
Today, as women, we also have a role in coming out and carrying the demands like the rest of the protesters. We want this regime to go down because it is a paternal and sectarian system, which has oppressed women's issues and has put us at the mercy of the religious authorities for years.
President Aoun addressed the nation on Sunday, promising to focus on corruption, the economy, and the civil state, but acknowledging there is no easy road ahead. Last week, he promised that the next cabinet would include several ministers selected for their skills and not political affiliation. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOAIE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Nick Ivanov. I'm Jackson Vungany in Washington. Have a good day, everyone.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.